Welcome to Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. Next week, voters in New York will go to the polls in both the Democratic and Republican presidential primaries. It's widely believed that Donald Trump will easily win the GOP primary. And former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton has a double-digit lead over Senator Bernie Sanders in the Democratic race. But the Sanders campaign thinks it's prime for an upset. Last night, the two candidates met in a testy debate in Brooklyn. One issue was raising the minimum wage to $15 an hour.
I have stood on the debate stage with Senator Sanders eight prior times.
Excuse me.
I have said the
Secretary,
exact same
Senator,
thing.
Please.
If we can raise it to $15 in New York or Los Angeles
Secretary,
or Seattle,
the viewers,
let's do it.
If you're both screaming at each other, the viewers won't be able to hear either of you.
Okay. What are some of the key issues and factors in the New York race? These are some of the questions we have for our guest today. Gerald Benjamin, a longtime political science professor at the State University of New York at New Paltz, and also Casey Seiler, who's a veteran political reporter for the Albany Times Union. Great to have you both on the program today. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having us.
It's a pleasure.
Professor, let's begin our discussion with a look at the Democratic presidential race, and then we'll shift gears and look at the Republican contest a little later in the program. So that was some debate last night. What are your thoughts about that debate? Is it what you expected, and do you think it will have much of an impact on the outcome of the vote next Tuesday?
I don't think it will have much impact. I think that there are kind of some fundamental elements to the circumstance that are going to be defining and determinative, and I think the debate is reinforcing of people already who've already made up their minds. We have a closed primary system in New York. Independents can't vote. People enrolled in third parties can't vote. People who have partisan affiliations are inclined to pay greater attention, and I think that it's substantially there's not the prospect of a late surge by unknown or unanticipated voters that I think will occur.
So Bernie Sanders has done very well in states that allow independents to vote. As you just mentioned, you've got to be a registered Democrat to vote in the primary next Tuesday. How is this going to affect the Sanders campaign?
Well, I think that Hillary Clinton was elected twice in New York. She has a very deep and wide set of relationships among elected officials in New York and active partisans. I think it has to be a firewall for her. If by chance she fails in New York, then the superdelegates, I think, are going to start reconsidering their commitments. So a lot is at stake for her, but she also has a very substantial advantage, and Sanders is running very much uphill in New York.
And Professor, political and presidential candidates are often asked if a particular primary election is a must-win for their campaign. As you just mentioned, very important for these candidates. So let's look at some scenarios and tell me how it might affect the race. Let's say Clinton wins by double digits. That's what the polls are showing right now. What would be the effect of that kind of victory?
Well, first of all, the margin of victory in these dual primaries in New York is a curiosity to me. You know, the size of the Trump, I know I'm going off topic, but the size of the Trump margin is contingent on there being two opponents. But putting that aside, Clinton, if she gets a substantial and decisive win, will confirm that she's the party's best choice, notwithstanding her negatives, to win the presidency. I think it'd be fundamental. Also, her firewall in previous primaries was in states that are inclined to be Republican, and this is very much a Democrat state, so that makes it even more important, not only the margin, but the place where she wins the margin. So I think it could be psychologically very important going forward among people who are more pragmatic and will be consequential at the convention.
Well, let's say it's close. Let's say she wins by one, two, or three. What's that impact?
Well, I think winning or losing is significant, but if it's close, it's encouraging the persistence of opposition is encouraged. Sanders is encouraged, and the final door in the minds of the most active and engaged people is not closed. So if she should be upset, then I think her candidacy is in real trouble.
And if Sanders wins, does that just make this a brand new race?
Well, I don't think it's a brand new race, but I think it's extremely troublesome. I think that what would follow would be a very, very aggressive attempt to confirm and reinforce the superdelegates' commitments. And I think that if Sanders could then follow with an erosion among superdelegates where he could have a press release a day saying these two people are coming over, these three people are coming over across the country, I think that that could redefine the race.
Today in the program, we're looking at next week's New York primary, the presidential primary. You can join the conversation here at Vermont Edition. Give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. You can always send us an email at vermontedition@vpr.net. Your thoughts about this primary. And if you're listening to us in New York State, we would love to hear from you today about your views on these contests. Will you be voting in the Democratic primary, the Republican primary? Who are you supporting and why? What are the most important issues to you in this race? What kind of impact will it have on the outcome of both the Republican and Democratic contests? 1-800-639-2211. Casey, what were your thoughts about the debate last night as you watched it unfold?
I agree with Gerald Benjamin, without a doubt, on all things always. But I don't think that the debate moved the needle in any way. And in all the polls that we've seen over the course of the last couple of weeks, the number of undecided Democratic voters or Democratic voters who are not really pretty dead set on their candidate at this point is well low into the single digits. The polls all show Clinton with a double-digit lead of between 10 and 14%. That's tightened a little bit in the more recent polls, but not beyond 10%. That's kind of her firewall. I do agree that she absolutely needs to win it. I think it would be a real wound for her campaign at this point if she loses, certainly. But I think also if it's only a win of 5% or less, this is, as noted, her adoptive home state that she represented for 8 years in the Senate. She has been blitzing the state. Her husband has been all around as well. He'll be in the Capital Region in Albany or just outside of Albany tomorrow. She's been in Rochester, Syracuse. She was in Albany a week and a half ago. So she's not taking this home state for granted. And you have to remember that the primary battle, there's the final percentage, and then there's also the delegate apportionment. On the Democratic side, they're going to be fighting over 163 delegates that are doled out on the congressional district level, between 5 and 7 delegates per congressional district. About 3/5 of those districts are downstate, New York City, Long Island, and its suburbs, and the rest of them are upstate, and some of them are in very strange shapes, congressional districts being what they are. So it's really almost like 27 primaries as opposed to one big state primary. And it's the same thing on the Republican side. But there, well, on the Democratic side, the delegates will be apportioned proportionally, depending upon how well Clinton and Sanders do in a specific district. On the Republican side, there are 3 delegates per district. If anybody gets more than 50%, that person gets all 3 of those delegates added to their column. If they get less than 50% and another candidate gets more than – clears the 20% margin, the winner will get 2, the second place finisher will get 1, and then the statewide winner on the Republican side will get an additional 14 delegates. So that's a total of 95, 27 congressional districts, 3 delegates apiece plus 14. So sorry for that long answer, but there you go.
But it's very important to know that. So if folks look at the results and it turns out that one of the candidates gets 55% of the vote, that doesn't necessarily mean they're going to get 55% of the delegates.
That mean on the Democratic side, it means that they will get 55% of the delegates or something very close to it. But once again, that's depending upon how they do on the specific districts. But on the Republican side, if somebody does very, very well statewide and they manage to spread that around to all those congressional districts, and that's really what it's looking like Donald Trump is going to do. All of the polls that we've seen show him doing well in New York City, where he's strongest, in the very important suburbs, including Long Island, and upstate. He is rocking and rolling in all three of those regions. And if he can post up better than 50% in a lot of those congressional districts, he can really run the table delegate count wise.
Well, what's really there is another really interesting dimension to this, and that in congressional districts in New York City, some congressional districts, there are very few Republicans. So
yeah,
winning 50% could mean winning 500 or 600 votes. So it's very amenable to organization because of the dearth of Republicans in the city. And another interesting thing, upstate, just taking a cue from the gubernatorial campaign, there was enormous enthusiasm for a candidate to the left of Governor Cuomo among Democrats. So that suggests, if that persists, and that was Zephyr Teachout, and if that persists, then Sanders might do well because of the ideological predisposition of the activist voters, Democrat voters, in areas that are usually regarded as Republican in New York. So there are wheels within wheels.
It's funny that Professor Benjamin would mention that. Just yesterday, I spent a lot of time looking at the results in the gubernatorial primary race that he's referring to, which is the 2014 Democratic gubernatorial battle between Andrew Cuomo and Zephyr Teachout, who, much like Bernie Sanders, Zephyr Teachout, who is also from Vermont, grew up in Vermont, is a progressive, was definitely coming at Cuomo from the left. Cuomo at the time was dogged by an ethical scandal involving his Moreland Commission to investigate public corruption that had been mothballed early by him. So somewhat analogous to the email debate or scandal, what have you, that Secretary Clinton is now facing. And if you looked at where Cuomo's support was strongest, it was in New York City. It was in the five boroughs. It was in the northern suburbs and out on Long Island and in western New York. Zephyr Teachout did very well. She won many, many counties upstate, but of course the turnout was just in many cases abysmally low. And if you wanted to extend that idea, you could look back to the Republican gubernatorial primary of 2010, where Carl Paladino, who in all respects is almost a state-level version of Donald Trump, a Buffalo real estate businessman who was energized by the Tea Party, came out of nowhere. His campaign initially thought to be something of a curiosity, and he absolutely stomped an establishment Republican candidate from out on Long Island, who was former Congressman Rick Lazio, who you may recall holds the dubious distinction of being the first guy to ever lose to Hillary Clinton in an electoral battle. He was the gentleman who ran against her in 2000 when she initially ran for the U.S. Senate. And Carl Paladino, Rick Lazio won downstate. He won Long Island, but he won just a couple of very shallowly voted counties across the North Country in the Adirondacks, but Carl Paladino won every other part of upstate. Absolutely, I think it was something like a 2-1 win by Carl Paladino. That is what Trump is hoping for, and needless to say, Carl Paladino is a major booster of Donald Trump. Tried to get Trump to run for president in 2012, and he was very strong behind him making a gubernatorial run against the aforementioned Andrew Cuomo in 2014.
Interesting. Professor Benjamin, Hillary Clinton has been strongly critical of Bernie Sanders' position on guns, first for his vote exempting gun manufacturers from liability in cases of gun violence, and for defending Vermont's less restrictive gun laws. Here's what she said last night in the CNN debate.
I have stood ahead on the debate stage with Senator Sanders. We have a problem in America. We need a president who will stand up against the gun lobby. We need a president who will fight for common sense gun safety reforms. And what we have here is a big difference.
So, Professor, how big an issue is this in the New York primary?
Well, first of all, I think that we need to understand that candidates for presidency have to distinguish themselves from each other, and they have to draw upon the record of the of their opponents, notwithstanding whether that record is rational or reasonable, given the representational obligations of their opponents, and both are doing it. There is the constituency, and Clinton's doing it with regard to this issue, and Sanders is doing it with regard to a number of other matters, in particular the Iraq War. So I think that people who care, again, that people who care about these issues will be compelled by the point, and I think there's a broad constituency. There's a broad predisposition in the Sanders constituency that would be in favor of gun control. So it's trying to create a vulnerability within the natural constituency of the opponent. My inclination is to say that if there are one or two things that you disagree with about your favorite candidate, and yet you agree with the overall message, you agree with the anti-Wall Street argument, you agree with the anti-banks argument, if you agree with the 1% argument, you agree with the fundamental unfairness, you're angry about your condition economically, and you have a position on gun control that's at variance with your candidate, you're going to make an exception. Most people realize that a candidate can't be absolutely perfect on all issues. So in net terms, the question is how many points of difference can you define for your between your opponent and his or her core constituency, not whether you can find one or two. That's my judgment on that.
Today on the program, we are looking at the New York primary next Tuesday. Our guest today, Gerald Benjamin, political science professor at the State University of New York at New Paltz, and also Casey Seiler, who is a veteran political reporter for the Albany Times-Union. Your thoughts, 1-800-639-2211. This is Vermont Edition on VPR. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. We're looking at next week's presidential primary in New York State. Our guests, Casey Seiler, political reporter for the Albany Times-Union, and also Gerald Benjamin, political science professor at the State University of New York at New Paltz. Your thoughts, 1-800-639-2211. Casey, at that debate last night in Brooklyn, Senator Sanders continued to hammer Hillary Clinton for her ties to Wall Street, especially after Clinton said that as a senator, quote, she called out the banks on their risky behavior.
Secretary Clinton called them out. Oh, my goodness. They must have been really crushed by this. And was that before or after you received huge sums of money by giving speaking engagements behind them? So they must have been very, very upset by what you did.
Casey, how much is this issue resonating with New York voters?
I think it's resonating in a big way. Among Sanders supporters, it's resonating strongly, I think. I believe that in the debate, Sanders kind of won that game, if you're thinking of this as a tennis match, which at times it very much felt like. I think that Sanders was not able to articulate the Wolf Blitzer's question, Sanders was asked to point to a specific action that Clinton had taken because of the influence of Wall Street. He did not have a very strong answer there. His response was essentially all the things that she could have done that she didn't do. But I thought that Clinton really muffed her defense of not releasing the transcripts of the speeches that she has given to some fairly large Wall Street firms. She basically said that she would do it if everybody else did it. And, of course, Sanders noted that he doesn't have any speeches like that. And the idea that Clinton would hold herself to standards that she would expect, for example, the three remaining Republican candidates to live up to, I thought was really it felt like a dodge to me watching it, and I think it felt like a dodge to many other people as well.
You know, this is a perfect example of what I was talking about previously. Vermont is a state that is largely rural, doesn't have large cities, has lots of hunters, have people who care about guns, and the senator finds the need to represent the constituency of Vermonters. Clinton represented a state where Wall Street and the big banks are massive employers. Now, that doesn't mean she may be compromised by accepting large contributions in some people's minds, but her advocacy for her constituency requires certain behavior, and it's true of Senator Schumer too in New York. These are industries that are the New York City economy drives the state economy and is fundamental to the national economy. Now, that doesn't mean that you have to be an apologist for the banks or for Wall Street, but the vulnerabilities created by the nature of the representative function for the senator.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. The idea that a New York State politician would not have a relationship of some kind, and hopefully a good one, with those firms, which, as the professor absolutely points out, is responsible for a huge chunk of state revenue. You know, the state budget, it doesn't quite rise or fall, but it comes close to rising or falling on revenue from the financial industry, bonuses for Wall Street executives. It would be as if, you know, Bernie Sanders didn't have some kind of relationship with the you know, higher education in Vermont or the maple syrup industry, you know, an equally kind of characteristic Vermont sector.
Let's go to our callers. A lot of folks would like to weigh in on this topic today. Let's start off with Sue, who is calling from Westport, New York. Hi, Sue. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Bob. I just wanted to say that I'm a native New Yorker and a registered Democrat. And I really resent the fact that Hillary Clinton has used New York State to promote her political career. She became a New Yorker when she wanted to run for this vacant Senate position. And I don't think that it's coincidental that before leaving office, her husband, Bill Clinton, signed into law the repeal of the Glass-Steagall Act, which greatly benefited the banking industry to the detriment of the little guy. And that industry, in turn, has been funding her run for the Senate and for the presidency. And the top five campaign funders are Citicorp, Inc., and J.P. Morgan, and Goldman Sachs. And it really appears to be that there's a washing of each other's hands here with the Clintons and the big banks. I don't know if your speakers have anything to say regarding that.
Professor, what do you think?
I think it's a fair point. I think that she established a relationship with her constituency, and they find that relationship amenable, and they're supporting her. I think that's a fair point. I did want to comment on something though, and this may I don't mean to be provocative here, and Hillary Clinton has a very obviously a very prominent husband. But, you know, feminist friends of mine make it very clear that they're not accountable for their spouses. When Bernie Sanders quoted something Bill Clinton had said 20 years ago and suggested that it was racist and wanted to hold Hillary Clinton accountable for it, I said, wow, you know, when I was a dean of a college and I wanted to talk to one of two people who were married to each other, and I dared send a message through the other one, I would get all kinds of negative response. You know, let's talk about Hillary's – this is a fair point that the caller made about Hillary. But let's talk about Hillary's record, and insofar as she helped create the record of the Clinton administration, let's talk about that. But let's not talk about random behavior or incidental behavior 20 years ago by Bill Clinton as disqualifying of Hillary Clinton. And on the question of, I'm certainly not an advocate, by the way, of Hillary Clinton. I don't think I would vote for president. So that's context.
Casey?
And on the question of the caller mentioned that she, of course, moved to New York essentially to glom onto what was becoming an empty Senate seat, but vacated by Daniel Moynihan. That's sort of in the great New York tradition. You know, Robert Kennedy, of course, was a senator from New York. Our state legislature is filled with people who come from far, far away, and in many cases, you know, immigrants, people who arrived here not as U.S. citizens, became citizens, and are now state lawmakers. This is New York City certainly is, as many people have observed, a city of immigrants, but New York is a state of immigrants, even upstate in many regards. So she certainly moved quickly from Washington to New York to become a senator, but that was never seen within the state as being disqualifying by the electorate, clearly.
You can join the conversation today here at Vermont Edition as we look at next week's primary in New York State. Our phone number, 1-800-639-2211. Perhaps you have some thoughts. If you live in New York, we especially would like to hear from you. 1-800-639-2211. Let's talk to Helen, who is calling from Windsor. Hi, Helen. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. My comment is that Bernie Sanders is running on the Democratic ticket, but he's not a Democrat. He ran against Madeleine Cunin and lost. Paul Krugman wrote a column in the New York Times and said he advised everybody to vote against Bush. And now he does not recommend Bernie Sanders. So my another comment is, I'm going to use the word that should not be used. I'm for Hillary, who is more, quote unquote, qualified.
Okay, Helen, thanks very much for your comments. Professor Benjamin, what about this idea that Bernie Sanders is coming to the Democratic Party pretty late in the process?
Well, Donald Trump is coming to the Republican Party late in the process. It raises questions about the nature of political parties and the nature of our nominating process, which are fundamentally important. I mean, the progressive movements spent a lot of time and energy trying to destroy political parties and the party organization's control of the nominating process, and we're experiencing the legacy of that what turns out to be, I think, the unanticipated legacy of that outcome. So people who have ambition and energy is fundamental to democratic society. Ambition is not a bad thing. People who have ambition find their opportunities and they move into those opportunities. And if we don't want to present those opportunities to those people, then we have to structure our institutions and processes to deny them. That's crucial. If we wanted to have a born in the state requirement for running for public office, well, Bernie Sanders couldn't have run for senator in Vermont, and of course Hillary Clinton couldn't have run for senator in New York. I wonder whether that would be constitutional, but it's an illustration of the point. People take the opportunities where they find them, and it's up to the systemic definitions to include or exclude them.
Also, Casey, right after the debate last night, Senator Sanders flew to Italy to attend a Vatican conference on social, economic, and environmental issues. It's pretty unusual for a candidate to leave the campaign trail just days before the primary election. What do you make of this decision?
Well, I agree with you, and it does. It takes him off the campaign trail for about 24 hours or more, if you include all the travel time. I think you can make of it the fact that this pope is seen as a very progressive pope, certainly within the recent line of pontiffs. And I think that a lot of the things that Francis has been talking about in terms of economic inequality, certainly as well as environmental issues and climate change, responds to and reinforces a lot of the things that that Bernie Sanders has been talking about on the campaign trail. And it doesn't hurt that New York State has a lot of Catholics. I think one of the highest per capita Catholic states in the nation. That can't hurt. Of course, many of those Catholics these days don't always follow what the Pope says, but I think in a deep blue state like New York, the combination of progressive and Catholic is a potentially potent one. It's intriguing because, of course, this Pope has had his differences somewhat with Donald Trump as well when he's talking about immigration issues. So I guess we'll see if, in fact, there is a there's a Pope effect in the New York State primary next week.
Historically, New York ambitious New York politicians were advised to go to the Three I's, to visit the Three I's, Israel, Italy, and Ireland. Of course, the demographics of the state have shifted. But winning votes by going abroad is not a new idea in New York.
Today in the program, we're looking at next week's primary in New York State. Your thoughts either on the Democratic side or the Republican side, 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. If you do live in New York State, we would love to hear from you. When we come back, we're going to take a look at that Republican race as well. This is Vermont Edition on VPR. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. Today we're looking at next week's primary in New York State. Our guest today, Casey Seiler, a veteran political reporter for the Albany Times Union, and Gerald Benjamin, political science professor at the State University of New York at New Paltz. Your thoughts, 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Professor Benjamin, let's take a look at the Republican race. What are your thoughts about the whole Trump phenomenon from a political science point of view? What is going on?
Well, my private view, for which I have no evidence, is that Mr. Trump started out to establish and further establish the Trump brand, and he was among the most surprised people in the country when it worked. I think it shows a deep flaw in our nominating process. I think he's been a vehicle for upset. These are not new ideas. Great upset and anger in elements of the population, middle and lower middle class white people whose economic circumstance has been really compromised in the last decade or two decades. And in a way, the protest vote for Trump is very similar from a different direction than the protest to the protest vote for Sanders. I think those things are true. I think that it's scary because it's not a substantive candidacy and it's not an informed candidacy. And that our system and process doesn't insist upon informed and prepared candidates for president structurally or operationally is a scary thing, given the president's responsibility not only in the country but in the world. So it's a very troubling to me, a very troubling development, and suggests that we have to reconsider our institutional arrangements for nominating candidates for president.
Why do you think he's doing so well? What's he tapping into?
Well, the first question is how well is he doing in the country as opposed to whether this is entirely political. So the range and the size and scope of the phenomenon needs to be considered critically. And I think he's doing well. The phenomenon is interesting to people. My sense of, I wasn't present, but my sense at the Albany rally was that people wanted to be present because they thought something would happen. They weren't, and they engaged in this kind of robust cheering behavior as that you might find in a kind of
sporting event.
Sporting event. Mm-hmm. So they're kind of cheering on somebody, and almost it's a gladiatorial kind of phenomenon. But I do think that there's great anger. I think white men are seeing the country get more diverse, and many who worked in manufacturing and related kinds of professions where they've made good livings have found themselves financially constrained. I think the social change in America is massive and for some people threatening. And I think this is an outlet for and a reaction to that. I go to a gym to work out, and a lot of the guys there are small business owners and workers for the state and workers in small businesses. And they find him to be a truth teller, which I find extraordinary, because when you look behind the statements, there's either no substance or fundamental error time after time. But there's that feeling, that belief. He's a guy putting his finger in the eye of the so-called establishment, and I think people are encouraged by that and support that.
And I think there's another part of it, and that is the fact that the Republican Party for a long time now, and certainly going back to 2008, part of the Republican brand and a growing part of the Republican brand has been telling you that large institutions, you know, what was Ronald Reagan's line, government isn't the answer, government is the problem, or something to that effect. You know, that has been part of the Republican appeal for a long time. And I think you are seeing in Trump, to a certain extent, the apotheosis of that manner of thinking. It has come back to bite the party establishment that saw that appeal as a way to enlist a lot of the white working class folks that formed part of Reagan's coalition. You are seeing the Rockefeller Republicans being faced with a candidate that they could have never contemplated before. Rockefeller Republicanism, of course, being born in New York, 50 years ago. So
let's go back to our callers and talk to Pat in Woodstock. Hey, Pat, what's on your mind?
Good morning, Bob. This is the reason that my vent got a little bit higher when I heard that about Bernie being invited to Rome. Basically, Bernie Sanders invited himself to that. That was not kind of an engraved invitation from the Pope. He invited himself to that. And I just have two more points to make. He really is trying to position himself as the great rescuer. The previous caller from New York said that she didn't like the way that Hillary was gravitating onto the New York political scene as being New York. Well, Bernie's doing the same thing. And when it comes to millennials, for millennials who are used to free apps, free this, free that, obviously, the call to free education, and everything else, is a great call, but it doesn't work. You know, in the state here in Vermont, we're having a hard time just making ends meet with the state, and a lot of that comes from the liberal giveaway to everything to everybody. So, just I think that as a female, I just kind of rankle with a lot of the male take on a lot of the different issues that are going on with that. When a woman is experienced, she's, quote, comes with baggage. But when men are experienced, they're supposed to be experienced. So I think that there is a double standard today in a lot of this political back and forth. I hope that Hillary wins, I'm sure, you know, and I'm sure that there's a lot of other people who are also for that. But everybody in the world is not for Bernie. So thank you, Bob. Thanks for a great show.
Okay, thanks for calling, Pat. Professor Benjamin, what about Pat's point? Some sort of gender bias?
Interestingly, I was listening to another public radio show this morning about Britain's vote to exit Europe, and there's a campaign among people who want to stay in Europe called "Talk to Your Grandma," or the British equivalent. And the idea is to advocate for staying in Europe with people who are inclined to depart. Now, we have a generation gap difference between a younger – I think the caller's point is well taken. And I think that we have a generation gap between older and younger women. Younger women are – that I know, at least, are inclined toward disproportionately inclined toward Sanders, and maybe it should be just the reverse. Maybe the grandmothers and mothers should be talking to their daughters and reminding them of the feminist movement's transformative presence in America in the last century and its goals and its difficulties. That would be a potential strategic approach for Hillary.
I guess I'm unique. My mother is a strong advocate for a single payer healthcare system, and she is older than Hillary Clinton by a couple of years, and is a strong advocate for Sanders. She has taken to Twitter with the alacrity of the most diehard, 22-year-old. So I guess that I social media, I think, might break down a couple of those. A couple of those categories, perhaps.
Interesting.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to Greg, who's calling from Plattsburgh, New York. Hey, Greg, welcome to the program.
Hey, thank you.
What's on your mind today, Greg?
Well, I just want to say that the young people of our country need to vote for Bernie Sanders because he is the only one that is advocating for the kind of change that our country needs. The rich keep getting richer and the poor keep getting poorer. And he, yes, wants to give away a lot of things or make things more accessible. But if our government didn't have all these schemes going on of people hiding money in other foreign countries and avoiding tax and paying their fair share of tax, these problems wouldn't persist because there would be money for it. So my thing is, he actually wants to help our country. He actually wants to do the things that we need as a whole, and that's what matters.
Okay, Greg, thanks very much for your phone call. Going to try to get a few more calls in before the end of the program, starting with Jay, who is calling from Greenwich. Hey, Jay, welcome to the program.
Hi. First-time caller. I'm a little nervous.
That's okay. What's on your mind?
I wanted to say that I find it a little offensive to be called a protest vote. I think we hear that a lot. The implication is that Bernie voters are just trying to push Hillary in a direction, and that's not true at all. I registered in time to become a Democrat just to vote for Bernie. So I think it's worth noting that a lot of voters in this election won't stay with the Democratic Party or support Hillary Clinton if Bernie's not the nominee. He does better with independents in the polls, and that's crucial in the general election nationwide. And if Bernie's not the Democratic nominee, I would, because I live in New York and it's we have millions more Democrats than Republicans, I can safely vote for Jill Stein. So,
okay,
it's,
Jay.
It's Bernie, and we're not going to migrate to Hillary, a lot of us.
Okay, Jay, we really appreciate your phone call. Professor Benjamin, what about this idea? As this race gets pretty testy and feisty, and people are going back and forth, Clinton and Sanders saying some pretty nasty things about each other last night. Is there a danger that if Hillary Clinton does win this race, that a fair number of Sanders supporters will say, hey, we're not going to vote in this election?
Well, it's hard to predict without knowing the alternatives. I mean, the behavior of people in general. I respect the gentleman's comment that and I don't want to dismiss his vote as only a protest vote, as read negatively. I would say that my intent in talking about that is the mobilizing nature of Sanders' appeal is that he mobilizes people on things that they're angry about and want, and they found a champion who agrees with them. So I think he's made a fair point that if there's a negative connotation, it should be avoided. Regarding what people will do, it depends on the alternatives they're presented with and the consequence. As the gentleman also rightly points out, we don't have a national election in the United States. We have 51 state elections. And so people might calculate that the worst-case outcome for them won't occur in their state if they don't vote and they'll stay home. Other people, if they abstain, might have a consequence to the outcome in their state. So the circumstances and the determination to vote or not vote is And affirmatively not voting is an interesting behavior. It's different than being indifferent. If I'm clear on that.
Yeah.
So I think it's all contingent on the circumstance, the alternatives that are available, and the circumstance in the state, and how they're perceived by the people who are making those choices.
Well, it's going to be fascinating to see what happens on Tuesday night in New York State. Many thanks to our guest today, political science professor Gerald Benjamin, who teaches at the State University of New York at New Paltz, and also Casey Seiler, a veteran political reporter at the Albany Times Union. Many thanks for being on the program today.
My pleasure.
It was a pleasure. Take care.
That is Vermont Edition for today. Monday, it's our annual spring bird migration show. Bird diva Bridget Butler will be here to discuss bird behavior, spring migration patterns, and tips on birding. Vermont Edition is produced by Rick Sengary and Sam Gale Rosen, with assistance from Anna St. Marie. Mary Williams directed the program. Our executive producer is Patty Daniels. I'm Bob Kinzel. Have a great weekend.